I have a bigger challenge, which is that even beyond this external assumption that the truth can only come from someone else, I believe that it leaves out the most important external consideration, which is external to the company, the stakeholder beginning with the customer or consumer. So that needs to be the starting point of performance, which drives everything in a regenerative paradigm.
Welcome to Business Second Opinion Podcast. Today, we're taking on another listener question. What is the future of performance appraisal and management? First, can you guess what I'm drinking? A Rebel Tasty Elixir. Actually, this one is Three Roots Mango Spice. This creamy, fruity elixir features three legendary Ayurvedic roots known to support whole body wellness and deep synergistic effects when combined. Rebel is not only the sponsor of our podcast here on Business Second Opinion, but they create righteous plant alchemy, which means it's good for you, your body, your being, and Mother Earth. They also go a step further to co-create a future without human trafficking. Rebel donates 2.5% of all net sales to Not For Sale. And through impact sourcing, they help communities to thrive and prevent their vulnerability to trafficking in the first place. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel."
We're so proud to be associated with them and to let you know that Rebel and Not For Sale were named finalists in Fast Company's 2019 World Changing Ideas Award. They were, and for recognizing their commitment to using business as a tool for positive impact in the world. Find out more about Rebel at www.rebel.co. And you can find purchase locations there.
Business Second Opinion is the podcast that digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. Ones you may not know you need to be asking, we believe you should be asking. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. As you know, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartout. With me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big, hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So as our regular listeners know, we invite people to send questions or subjects they're wrestling with in the world of business and business practice. And we select one to try to build a show around. And as a thanks, we also started sending you all, the people who send it in anyways, one of our new Get a Second Opinion ceramic mugs. So today, we selected one that definitely grabbed us. The subject is, what will the future of performance management look like in 10 years? Big companies are giving up annual reviews and 360-degree feedback, but what exactly do you all think is going to replace it? Harvard Business Review gives us some hint and some history of performance management practices, but we can possibly assume that they are still from an earlier paradigm and could certainly use some evolving. That sound about right, Carol?
Right. You know, you can check them for yourself, and our listeners can, because we list the articles in our show notes on our Business Second Opinion website. But you're really right, because the new pieces have mostly the same paradigm problem in their new offerings as they had in the old one. It's, again, just a little variation. They have specifically identified some problems that on the surface, I think they didn't dig deep enough, and they ran into problems and stepped back into what was familiar, which is the old paradigm of behaviorism. So mostly what they're offering are just some more ameliorations to get rid of the bag of stuff, which we talk about often.
All right. So what are they starting from exactly that had them miss these blind spots, do you think, Carol?
Well, funny you should mention blind spots, since the first article by Buckingham and Goodell gives a good rundown of the old performance review position. With some impressive research behind it, they show the holes, including a big one we come back to here, which is cognitive bias. The funny thing is, I believe that they're demonstrating that with their own example of going to what's familiar, which is a cognitive bias, going to what we know, which is behavioral. Then they tell us that we have to overcome these biases with a new set of practices, but I think you'll see during the show that that's not actually the case. they do acknowledge, which I give them credit for, that they're stuck on one problem they cannot figure out how to solve. And we're going to come back to it because I think it's because they're missing this paradigm blind spotness. Is that a word? And they're still in the behavior paradigm and cannot conceive of another way to enter the world of performance review. And the same is true of their new book that came out this summer called 9 Lies About Work.
So let me remind people what they might notice as they examine the behavioral worldview behind their thinking. So first of all, it requires external assessment since people cannot see themselves. That is the core driver here. A regenerative paradigm wildly disagrees with this premise. Second, the external assessment extends to external motivation with incentives and rewards determined by others. A regenerative paradigm actually points to an undermining of deeper intrinsic motivation through this. And third, they propose to shift to manage behavior, or a shift to manage behavior, close in time and space, and less actually about outcomes. So now our listeners can do their own digging as well. But Carol, where do we start for this episode?
Well, one of the other articles we read by Capelli and Travis gives us just a brief bit of history, which I think is kind of fun and funny at the same time. They followed the ups and downs of performance management over the years, and management is more about adhering to standards versus performance development, which is more about growing people, and how the shift back and forth between that moved forward as the military design was adopted into commercial, but then the commercial process has shifted more into trying to develop people because they felt the other was too rigid. But it was so interesting, they pointed out as inflation and other environmental challenges arose, it could cause commerce to switch back to the military view. Particularly an example they gave was when you have to get and retain talent, then you have to do development. And that's very important. But if you're really flush with people in down markets or you've got inflation problems, that they went back to managing performance. Now, I was always a little surprised that in this history, they forget in their historical overviews that workers managed themselves completely independent before corporate America existed. Pretty much everyone worked for themselves in the craftsman era.
Before behavioral theory came along, there was no performance management in America. The only external force on small family businesses was actually the people that bought from them. And then, with the military, and particularly the World War II era, post-behaviorism, all of a sudden, there was this sudden loss of human capacity to be self-managing. Weird. So let's call that the second era after self-managed craftspeople.
Yes. And then coming forward, this current era that we're in is beginning to see the problems with performance systems that were designed under that behavioral theory of change, particularly the military version. Buckingham and Goodall offer a clear explanation of the downside of this second era that was adopted from the military. And a bunch of people are now, but that particular article we focused on. Overall, they have a new idea that they found through a survey they did inside of Deloitte to really try and understand performance management. And lo and behold, they discovered that performance management in all its guises was not driving a new level of employee involvement and participation or higher performance, which was the whole reason for the exercise. As a result, they targeted at Deloitte 3 shifts in objectives for the new system that they're installing. First, they're stopping the cascading of objectives from the top of the organization down all the way to the level of individual performance. Second, they're moving annual reviews, which also ended up ranking and rating every employee in the business against every other employee in the subgroups. And finally, they're stopping the feedback tools that were used at multiple levels and positions across the company.
Yes. In the military era, no matter where you were, the objectives were set at the beginning of the year. After a project is finished, the person's manager rates them according to how well objectives were met. This includes comments on where they did not meet or exceed performance objectives. Any of this starting to sound familiar to people out there? Then during a single year-end consensus meeting where a select group reviews everything, their process reviews people relative to their peers and each is given a rank and rating. In that situation, an intermediary who fought for you was the best you could hope for in order to help you excel. This is so clearly based on the assumption of an average, essentially tracking your deviance from behavioral rules, as well as reinforcing that only someone else can judge your performance.
Yeah, I'm sad as I hear that again, because we know there's no such thing as average. But anyway, after realizing that managers through this survey were spending, believe it or not, 2 million hours a year on this activity of performance management. And remember, their study showed that it was not improving performance or employee retention. Deloitte decided they had to shift something. And what they decided to do instead of this larger, grander scale thing is they were going to shift things down to the immediate manager, who would be the one who would do the feedback to the employee, but to do it in real time, preferably weekly or more often if it were possible. The focus shifted again from this broader cascading idea, and they stopped looking backward as much, like how did they do, and instead shifted to the idea of, hey, sit down and talk about what's coming up, what are you doing, how are you thinking about it, and being able to quickly then make shifts in the priorities that the employee had now in real time, plus speaking of any real problems and giving recognition immediately where they thought they were exceeding their performance measures.
Right. So they shortened the review period from 1 year to weekly and from hundreds of folks involved in the process to just one manager. But you notice it's still all based on the same paradigm of behaviorism, i.e. external reinforcement. All that really changed was the amount of time, right?
Well, it also is still inward facing. And I think we need to call that out. It's not connected to the market at all, at which we will talk about when we give you the alternative regenerative view. There were a few other changes, but they were all from the behavioral paradigm. That is, only someone else can see us, rate us, and give us incentive to be motivated. They did point out that the research shows that without a doubt, the evaluations of others tell us more about the person giving the evaluation and less about the person they are evaluating, because biases and projection of their own ideas were so limiting.
Yeah, you actually mentioned earlier they still had blind spots. That seems to be one of them, actually. So they reduced the number of people with cognitive bias by introducing what they called an idiosyncratic rater effect. I am doing air quotes right now, to one person. And what was left was now only the immediate manager with no one to balance their cognitive bias. Not that any of this is what we would want them to be doing anyways, but so they missed the point of the new design entirely. And it's still externally given, and self-management remains undeveloped in the worker throughout this entire process.
Right, and all of that's a problem, but I have a bigger challenge, which is that even beyond this external assumption that the truth can only come from someone else, I believe that it leaves out the most important external consideration, which is external to the company, the stakeholder beginning with the customer or consumer. So that needs to be the starting point of performance, which drives everything in a regenerative paradigm. And all interactions with the manager and the worker is problematic too, because it's focused on this close-in activity, which negates innovation. Just think about it. You have a manager telling you, and you're talking about what you're going to do next week and how well you're doing. Where is the time to really think about innovation and what else we could do, much less work at these multiple levels of getting stuff done and figuring out how to improve it? A small business owner has to do that, as did our craftsperson. So in a regenerative business, you have everyone thinking in these more nested, further out concepts. I feel like in some ways what they did is made things worse.
So what are the principles then, Carol, of regenerative performance management approach, I guess? I know it lets go of the idea we can't see ourselves and that we don't need to have our own motivation manipulated by others, but it also lets go of working for the man, quote unquote, or the direct manager and company for which the plan fosters, where nothing is done about cognitive bias.
It reinforces the working for the man and the direct manager, although, you know, that's always been there. All right. So you ask, what are the principles? Well, because they did objectives, I thought I would do objectives. And I have 8 objectives in a regenerative paradigm, which, by the way, what I'm going to be sharing with you was launched into corporate America by Procter & Gamble and a few other companies at the same time in the 1960s. So we're talking about the future, but this also has a huge track record. And interestingly, it was about the same time, it was being experimented and designed about the same time as the military model started in the 50s. Each objective that I'm going to offer is seeking the development of potential in each person in the organization, in the business as a whole, including financial effectiveness, which is tied to every worker directly as a part of what they know, how they're measuring their success. And the external piece, again, is ensuring that the business stakeholders each have new capacity after these folks have done something for them beyond just having their stated needs met. So the crazy thing is these 8 objectives that I'm going to share cannot be understood from a behavioral point of view. They don't make sense.
Or for that matter, the human potential paradigm is evidenced by Holacracy, right? They would seem impossible or irrelevant or not even needed. And that's because they are pursuing completely different ends than the objectives of the military or even Deloitte.
Yes, that's true. So what are they? So the first 3 regenerative objectives are: people are connected directly to market forces, including particular customers or consumers, and are expected to create endeavors individually or in teams to contribute through self-initiated contribution plans. Imagine that. Instead of somebody else handing things down, you're actually expected to come and understand that. So how do you do that? So objective number 2. In order to be connected to the market and company strategy, every person is part of something we tended to call a market field team. They are focusing on a particular market, but they're made up of cross-functional reflection of the organization as a whole and taking nested strategies back into the business. So they know intimately one particular part, and that gets shared across the company. Now, what do they do with that? So once you are connected to market forces, you know you're responsible via the support of a market field team for doing something for those stakeholders. You have the opportunity to work within a developmental infrastructure, which ensures that unique contributions are made, but are always tied to the strategy, as well as the organization's day-to-day work. But you do that at different levels and making a contribution rather than fulfilling an assignment. There's no hierarchy of persons, but there are roles that become able to work at greater levels of complexity and even on projects that take longer to accomplish. So the developmental infrastructure, and this is going to sound really strange, most plans have filled in here, work on this and this and this. The developmental infrastructure is open cells that bound the domains, the strategy, and the work that's being organized by the market field teams. And the people can look at that and say, there's where my energy needs to go. And it awakens that energy to go make a difference. What do you think of that?
So the first idea that's being outlined here is that when people are directly connected to the market, they no longer need intermediaries to digest and reduce information for them. Their connection to customers and the market actually gives them the clearest, most transparent picture they can get that they need to go about engaging in their work on a day-to-day basis. So the second is that being part of a market field team also ensures that one is connected to cross-functional teams within the business, as Carol said. So while one is externally facing customers in the market, one is also connected to the whole of the business in its various aspects without isolation or fragmentation of information. And third, developmental infrastructure is designed specifically to grow you as a person so that you can contribute directly to the market and your customers' lives in a way that actually builds transparency. How does that sound, Carol?
The only thing I want to reinforce is it's all within the context of the strategy of the business. So it's not inmates running the asylum, right? It's individuals engaged interactively with field teams. Otherwise, that was just perfect. But let's go to the next 3 principles, because they take us down to another level, which will point to how pay and progression ends up working. First, you have individuals who are initiating and leading the creation of their own development plan. I always say it's like ideation of it, creation of it and evaluation, where we normally divide those up. Somebody else ideates, then somebody else does the work, and then somebody else evaluates. Well, no, in this process, individuals are leading that. Now, they are using criteria that comes out of the market field team and the strategy so that they make sure they're serving the market. But there's another interesting thing that gets introduced here in this developmental infrastructure. There's something we call the portfolio investment team, which have measurable objectives about how money is going to get allocated. But it also is keeping it tied to shareholder capacity being introduced. When that happens and a developmental plan is completed by an individual, or it often happens in teams too, a pay event or action is triggered. Now, this may include a raise or gain sharing based on whatever the plan says. It's always tied to stakeholder contribution coupled with personally achieving new targeted ableness that's demonstrated by completing what you promised to do and having the plan met, all of which was agreed on upfront with this portfolio management team and with the market field team. There is always a developmental contribution plan. Everybody is always in one. So when you complete one, if that could be 3 months, but they're usually more like a year or 2 years because these are not simple things. When you complete one, you start developing the next, getting alignment, go to work. So that was number four. The fifth principle is that pay is tied to the proposed and aligned plans that are co-created in dialogue with the teams I just talked about. The portfolio investment team is one of the most important ones you have to check in with. A couple of things are really important about it. First, it gives full participation because anyone can be on this. This is not top level folks. It does have fiduciaries in it, so quick decision can be made, but it's rotating and the membership is normally recommended from the market field teams. And because anyone can attend a meeting and watch the processes and principles at work, there are no secrets because this team is managing a portfolio of funds, just like you would your own home portfolio of funds. And they know what the dispersion of that can be through a window of time, usually annually. They also are very tied to the strategy. People come to them to request funds, and sometimes that's for specialized education. Like Consolidated Disc Corporation had a guy named Jesse who decided he really wanted to make some major changes in how the rod and piston process was working for engines. And normally they handed it off only to their German engineering company, but he wanted to be the one who guided that. And this guy had an eighth grade education. He was super smart and had been a farmer, but he went and got permission to actually get an engineering degree while he was working side by side. It allowed then, as they were completed, for him to get an increased salary, which was agreed on up front, and some other compensation. All of the membership, as I said, in this portfolio team is chosen by the market field teams who have the most up-to-date sense of strategy. They know what's going on in the market, and therefore they know what it is that needs to be represented in the allocation decisions. By the way, this role of being on this team is often, at some point in time, many people have it as a part of their development plan, of which is number six principle. Everyone has a developmental plan. Now, it includes so much more than Buckingham and Goodall were thinking about, because it has in it how you're going to improve business effectiveness for a stakeholder, a customer, consumer, and to report that in terms of earnings, margins, and cash flow. Gosh, most people in a company don't know that. The executives barely can hang on to it. Well, in a regenerative organization, everybody knows it. They also, in their plan, have how they're going to improve functioning effectiveness in key areas that can be everything from managing site to HR. And they're going to leave the organization better for the work they've done. The third area their plans include is organizational effectiveness, how they're going to help teams, organizational activities, and even the developmental infrastructure we've been talking about be improved. Plus, this is weird. They're working on many levels at one time. They're working on getting their work done because they've got a regular working team they go to every day, whether that's a software design team or whether that's a production team. But they're also thinking about, while they work on that, what is a better way we could be doing this? How do we change something so we know we're in a better position in the market? They also are thinking about how it fits in with systems across the organization and how they could build better capacity in themselves and others. Now, you probably think that's impossible. As I said, most people who are used to behavioral and top-down can't conceive of this, but it's a natural way of working in a year or a little more in all organizations. So what do you think of that, Zach?
Whew, I think that was a lot, but I do have some reflections here because I think there's a lot here that I'd like to kind of highlight for folks. So I think the big shift here is that when you have someone lead something, you encourage them to develop internal locus of control, right? The belief that they are taking responsibility for what's going on. The buck stops with them, in other words. But when you have a manager, you foster external locus of control or the belief that everything is happening to them and they have little control over their life, right? Because essentially, it's all up to my manager. I don't really have a say in what's going on. The other thing I'm noticing here is how clearly the pay and progression process you outline solves the transparency issue simultaneously while working on cognitive bias. The key here, again, is that strategy is nested in a developmental plan in the same way that these teams are nested inside the organization. This nesting allows for direct communication and full information for decision making while enabling those on the teams to be working on themselves in the context of the business. How does that land?
That's a nice, elegant way to summarize the results you get from doing this. I want to build, I've got number 7 and 8. I want to do those quickly because they build off this internal locus of control. One of the evaluation characteristics by any team who is helping develop a developmental plan, reviewing and giving support or financial encouragement, it all is checked against the 3 core human capacities that I wrote about in the regenerative business. Whether locus of control, that is, you just pointed to, taking full responsibility is encouraged, and really getting the outcomes of people being more self-managed and self-directed, or not, because if it's going to undermine that, and the very things that Buckingham and Goodell are suggesting for Deloitte, or you just said, undermine that, and I really agree. Secondly, is it demonstrating the ability to build more external considering for those who they're serving, including suppliers, customers. And you can see that all of these plans are connected externally, not internally, where you become competitive. The activity itself, the very nature of it, is building personal agency. And then finally, and this is an answer to the question we can't hear anybody asking, but I'm sure they are, is, how in the world could people do this? You usually have to have managers to manage so much of this. It's so complex. Well, the answer is a regenerative organization has ongoing, recurring developmental sessions, which are way beyond training. They're not skills, but they're more about how to increase living system thinking on everything you look at in the organization, as well as self-management and team management, so that we are purposeful in the organization rather than reactive. And that is not an easy job, and that's why it's recurring, and it never stops, and everybody who's in the business is involved.
If people want to see more about how these principles and stories of how they get carried out look, check out Carol's books, particularly The Responsible Business for looking at how strategy is connected, and The Regenerative Business on how work systems can be structured to make this work through a series of stories to show how this varies such a great deal. And No More Feedback is another option, which has another set of stories building the capability of people to work this way and achieve the 4 objectives recommended.
And we should, in our final word here, say thanks to Max Scoot of Microsoft in San Francisco, who suggested this topic. We're sending you a Get a Second Opinion mug to hold your favorite hot or cold beverage. If you want one of those mugs, anybody else who's listening, send us a topic on practices in business that need a second opinion. You can email me at carol@businesssecondopinion.com, or you can find us on Twitter at biz_second_opinion. If we use it to develop an episode, you get a mug. And also your rating or review, for us, on any platform helps people find us and spread the word. Sign up for our newsletter so you get connected to the show notes and much more.
And thanks as always to Numi Tea. They sponsor our show notes and also are a local champion for the upcoming Regenerative Business Summit on November 19th. Check out the Business Second Opinion website where you can learn more about how your essence can become a powerful decision-making guide to grow your business. And join Numi Tea as a champion in your town. go ahead and check out the regenerativebusinesssummit.com. This has been Business Second Opinion.